Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John, a comedy podcast about death hosted by myself, John Green, and not my brother Hank Green, who is on tour, but instead my mom, Sydney Green.
Hi there, John Green.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. I'm great. Sort of missing Hank, but nice to see you.
I also miss Hank, but I'm very glad to have you here as a guest. So the way it works in this podcast is we answer your questions, we provide you dubious advice, and we give you all the week's news from both AFC Wimbledon and this week not news from Mars, but instead a recipe.
Yes, I'm very excited about the recipe.
I am too, because I just ate it for dinner last night and I thought it was delicious.
I know, it was delicious. Who knew?
So how are you doing, Mom?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to be here in Indiana. It's a beautiful summer, spring day. It's good to see the grandchildren.
Yeah.
Nice to see you.
We're excited about the Indy 500.
We're very excited about the Indy 500. I picked out my guys.
Who are you? Do you even know their names?
I do.
Who are your guys?
I have a personal love for Montoya just because of the Princess Bride.
The Inigo Montoya connection?
Yes, exactly. And if not him, I do like Simon just because he gave you such a hard time in the Grand Prix.
When I drove the pace car at the Grand Prix of Indianapolis, Simon Pagenaud, with whom I am personally acquainted, kept riding my bumper. He kept, I don't know if he was just trying to warm up his tires or if he wasn't satisfied with the speed at which the pace car was being driven, but he kept roaring up right up to my bumper.
I know.
It was frightening.
I know. So I sort of kind of like the idea of him winning.
So you like him.
And then, you know, you can't help but not like the pole guy.
Oh, yeah, James Hinchcliffe.
Yeah, that's
James
what
Hinchcliffe.
A story.
He's an amazing guy, really great, a lovely person, very generous, does tons of work in the community here in Indianapolis. So, of course, when this podcast is being actually listened to, the Indianapolis 500 will be in the past.
Yes.
So
it'll be interesting who we picked, if we picked correctly.
Right. Well, let's hope that it's James Hinchcliffe.
Yep.
Juan Pablo Montoya.
Yep.
Or Simon Pagenaud.
Yes.
That's who you're rooting for.
That's who I'm rooting for. Do you have similar or different?
I have an IndyCar fantasy league, so I root for the drivers that ended up in my fantasy league, which this year means Takuma Sato, Jack Hawksworth, Ryan Hunter-Reay, and Elio Castroneves. But I have a personal affection for Scott Dixon, so I'll also be very happy if he wins.
Yeah, he's a good guy too, yeah.
I know that's what people come to this podcast for, Mom.
I do too.
Is Indy 500 analysis after the Indy 500 has occurred?
That sounds perfect. It's a great podcast.
So, Mom, before we get to listener questions, I'm just hoping you can comment on something that happened in a recent episode of Dear Hank and John, which is that my brother apologized for having destroyed Tuggle, the cookie jar that, in fact, is not destroyed and is still living happily with you and Dad in Western North Carolina.
That's correct.
So tell us what actually happened.
Well, what actually happened was you destroyed... Well, Hank destroyed my last remnant of my college life.
Oh, wow. So you had a cookie jar all the way from college.
Yes, that what my one of my boyfriends had made and gave. It was his senior project, and he gave it to me. And Hank broke that. So I cried some just because that was the end of my college career.
This is like the last remnant
the
of
last
college
remnant.
That you had.
Yes, that was it.
And then it broke.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I thought we might start with a question about adulthood and what adulthood means. I'm going to be reading all the questions because I have the computer. Oh, wait, Mom, I forgot about the short poem.
You did. I was wondering. All right. I'm very excited about this.
I do have a short poem. You'll never guess what it's about.
Death?
It's about death. You're correct. This is a beautiful short poem by Langston Hughes, one of the all-time best short poets, in my opinion. He wrote, this poem is actually just called Poem. I loved my friend. He went away from me. There's nothing more to say. The poem ends soft as it began. I loved my friend.
Oh.
It might not be about death. It might just be about a friend breakup, but it's very sad, isn't it?
It is very sad.
I love the poem ends soft as it began.
I do too.
Oh, he's good. He's good.
Maybe you'll keep that one for my funeral.
Oh, goodness gracious. Must I? Must we go there?
Well, I don't know. It's a podcast about death.
Now people are seeing where I got the obsession from. Okay, all right, so we are going to try to answer this question about so-called proper adulthood. This question comes from Jade, who asks, "Dear John and Hank, a few times in the podcast you have referred to proper adults trademark, and I'm curious, how do you define adult? I'm assuming that adulthood is a scale, perhaps weighing age and experience, not a binary. Do you agree? Am I, a 25-year-old woman with an office job, a 401k, and great workplace benefits, more adult than my identical twin sister, who is a second-year law student? Does it matter that I am a minute older?" What do you think, Mom?
Well, you know, I'm still candidly thinking about the fact that my adulthood started when you guys broke my cookie jar.
So the answer, I think, Mom's answer is that adulthood begins when the last memory of your college boyfriend is destroyed by your children.
Yeah, there's something to that, isn't it? Yeah. Or I feel like both you and your sister probably are right there in adulthood.
Yeah, I think you're just making the transition. In my opinion, it's a long transition,
yeah.
And it ends when you can no longer plausibly say that you are not an adult. You know?
I think that's true, yeah.
And there just comes a day when you look up and you realize that you are definitely not an adult.
Yeah.
And therefore, you must be an adult.
Yes. Have you reached that stage?
For me, the critical moment looking back was when I put on an outfit. I've talked about this before on the podcast. And Sarah was with me. And I said, "I just feel like I look like a middle-aged man in this outfit." And Sarah paused for just like 1 second too long. And I realized that it had happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for you, it was the destruction
really,
of the cookie jar.
Yes, it was. Now you know why I cried so hard. And why you guys, even though you're so little, you remember it.
It is a very intense memory for me, although a faulty one, since Hank and I both thought that we'd destroyed Tuggle, the cookie jar that was shaped like a tugboat, which is in fact in perfect condition.
Yes, it is. Well, the nose has been rubbed. The paint has been rubbed away from the nose.
Well, but still, compared to the college boyfriend cookie jar, it's in great shape.
Yes, true.
So adulthood, in short, is a process, not an event, but it is marked by events, perhaps.
Oh, beautifully said. Yes.
Thanks, Mom.
You're welcome.
Gosh,
son.
You should always co-host this podcast. All right, we've got another question. This one comes from Lauren, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I am currently about 2 hours into a six-hour flight from New York City to San Francisco, and I'm sitting in the middle seat. I failed to lay claim to an armrest when we sat down, and now both the people in the aisle and the window seats are using both armrests. Since they have clearly not generalized the Dear Hank and John movie theater armrest rule to airplanes, do you have any ideas on how I might acquire some armrest real estate? Any dubious advice is appreciated. Best wishes, Lauren. P.S. The attached picture was taken while both guys were sleeping. I cannot tell you how anxiety-provoking the attached picture is. It's very upsetting to look at."
Oh, God. Oh. Mm. You know, this is why I've never divorced your father, because he understands the armrest rule, and he's always with me when we fly.
Okay, so one way or another, even if you're in the middle seat, you get an armrest.
Exactly.
Because you're sitting next to Dad.
Yes.
I think that's a really good, but I mean, you know, we probably just made Lauren's life worse.
Yeah, we probably did.
Because now she's like, "Great, I also don't have a flying partner."
Yeah, and I have been in that situation before, and it's just, only I remember mine, I was next to a basketball player, so he's very tall. So it was more than just the armrest.
His whole body.
Yeah.
But it's a hard thing because he's also having an unpleasant flight because he's probably 6'8"
exactly.
In a coach seat.
Yes. Yes.
So on the one hand, you want to be empathetic. On the other hand, you are suffering, and it's hard when you're suffering to be empathetic.
Yes.
So what would you do in this situation?
Well, you know, I actually would kind of look at both and look for the more empathetic one and lean over and ask him for the armrest.
Oh, you'd ask. See, what I would do.
Or sometimes.
I would put my arm down.
The gentle nudge.
If there's like one eighth of an inch of the armrest available for my arm, I will put that arm down and I won't make physical contact with the person, but my arm hair will make physical contact with his arm hair.
brilliant.
And then they get the nudge and they're reminded, I am in the middle seat. I am the one who deserves these armrests.
That's brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't like to brag, but that is what I do. I do believe if you are on the aisle or on the window and you use the middle seat's armrest,
that's rude.
You're a criminal.
Yeah, I think so too.
It's just terrible.
And I think the fact that your arm hair would touch their arm hair is a powerful statement of creepiness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't believe in touching strangers, but I don't mind if my hair touches their hair.
Okay, that just creeps me out completely.
Sorry.
Have a little shiver there.
I'm sorry, Mom. All right, we've got another question. That was upsetting. I probably shouldn't have answered that. Okay, Mom, we've got a very important question from Hannah, who writes, Dear Hank and John, my senior prom is swiftly approaching, and I'm having a major problem. First of all, her senior prom has probably passed, so sorry, Hannah, for not getting this advice to you in time. I'm sure you did fine. First of all, how do you even slow dance? Do you just sway back and forth? Is there any foot movement? How much space should there be between me and my date? Where does my head go? Help me with my problem. P.S. You guys should crash my prom. Sorry we didn't make it to your prom, Hannah, but here is your belated dubious advice on how to slow dance. Mom?
There's a lot of pause there because, you know, not so much do I dance, but in my day, when I was a teenager, I would practice with my friends, and we would kind of figure out what was most comfortable for us, and that's what I would do.
How long have you been married?
40 years.
Do you feel comfortable slow dancing with Dad?
No, I really dislike it.
You just don't like doing it?
I don't like dancing, and I don't like it.
You know that that famous sort of cliche phrase, dance like no one's watching?
Never has happened to me in my life.
That for me, the issue is that if no one's watching, I don't want to dance.
Exactly.
Yeah, I have no desire to be dancing.
Yeah.
I also have no desire to be dancing when people are watching. But like when I'm alone in my room listening to music, I am not one to boogie down.
No.
I am, however...
Hank. Hank.
Oh my God. Winter Park High School's best dancer.
Yes, he was.
In 1994, he was voted best dancer at Winter Park High School. You know, I used to introduce Hank on stage back when we toured a lot together. And whenever I would introduce Hank on stage, I would list his accomplishments. Inventor of 2D glasses, which render 3D movies in a crisp two dimensions. Founder of the environmental technology blog EcoGeek. And then I would say that the last thing I would always say is that in 1996 or whatever, he was named best dancer at Winter Park High School, which is true.
It is. It's absolutely true. And remarkable.
And he's a good dancer.
Oh, he's a great dancer.
He and Catherine can boogie.
Yeah.
Somehow it did not come to my half of the family.
No.
But as I am an expert in slow dancing, and here's my opinion. Just go with it. Just do what makes you feel comfortable. You should sway back and forth, and it's okay to turn, I think, in a slow circle. So some foot movement. I usually go in a clockwise circle. And then as far as how much space should be between you and your date, that's really a question of how comfortable you are with your date, and not something I feel particularly qualified to weigh in on. But I think, you know, just... if you're not comfortable with them, it's fine to just hold lock the elbows.
Yeah.
I think just lock the elbows.
Yeah.
And just do not touch except hand on waist, hand on shoulders, and just keep that physical distance. But if you're comfortable, then, you know, you can touch.
Yeah. I think that the arm lock also is kind of a sweet look.
I don't think that I'm... Before I got married, I don't recall ever slow dancing in a way that was... at all comfortable.
No, me neither. No.
And still, I don't love dancing, but Sarah does, like when we go to weddings, Sarah likes to dance.
I've noticed that. Songs. Yeah, fortunately, your dad still doesn't like to dance either, so.
That's nice.
It is nice.
I'm a little jealous. Yeah. I wish I'd married Dad.
Yeah, he's really, well, Sarah's nice, too.
Yes, no, I'm a fan of Sarah. She's great. You know, we just celebrated our 10th wedding anniversary.
I know. It's so exciting. You know, and it reminds me of that magical moment of when we danced And what was the song we danced to, dear?
Well, the podcast listeners know, Mom, because Merle Haggard just died.
He did just die. I heard that podcast.
It was Mama Tried by Merle Haggard. Yeah. I read the lyrics to Mama Tried as the short poem for that week.
That's right, you did. I forgot.
I had an Emily Dickinson poem all lined up, and then Merle Haggard died tonight.
Oh, Merle.
Oh, man. All right, Mom, we've got another question. This one is from Akif, who writes, "Dear Hank and John, I'm about to graduate from college. I'm an international student from a developing nation studying in the U.S., and I've always planned to go back and use what I've learned over here to help people back home. However, recently, my parents have been suggesting I try to get a job in the U.S. and embark on a more secure life in a developed country. I can see why they'd want me to do that, since there have been some recent incidents relating to radicalism back home, but I can't help but wonder if it would be extremely selfish on my part. On the other hand, I've always tried to keep my parents happy and listen to what they want me to do. Thus, I am in a dilemma and in desperate need of some dubious advice. How do I make them understand that we should sometimes think of the greater good in a way that they would be supportive of in my decision?" What a big, difficult, complicated question.
I am really curious, as your mother, and also knowing you're a father, how you would handle this.
way to deflect. Way to bring the ball over to my side of the court.
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is that I don't feel like we can give great advice here, because it isn't something that I have a lot of experience with. And also because I think it's an incredibly complicated, difficult decision. But I thought it was important to read it on the podcast, because I think it's important to remember, the complexities of big decisions like that that people have to face when they're quite young. I mean, this is a young person who's about to graduate from college, but has to make, a big decision about the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. When I was traveling in Ethiopia, we got to visit with recently graduated college students, and what really impressed me was that to a person, they were committed to development. They were committed to, education, engineering, fields where they thought that their talents and the privileges that they'd had as college students would really make a big difference. And that's not something that you see as much, I have to say, in the U.S. Like, when I was graduating from college, it didn't occur to me, how can I serve my country? Or even really, to be honest, how can I serve my community? Most of it was, can I get a good job that's going to, allow me to have a good life? And can it be in the world of the arts, which is the world that I love? There was something kind of selfish about it, looking mm-hmm. back. Mm-hmm. I would have made a terrible mechanical engineer, so there is that. But I thought this question really, really captured a difficult choice that some people make, that maybe lots of us take the conclusion for granted.
Yes, I really agree with you on that. When you live in such a world of privilege, like you and I ultimately do, it's almost impossible to visualize, and certainly it's impossible to give advice on such a very difficult, except to say, this is a time for you and your family to really join together in love and in honest, hard discussion.
I think that's really true. Somebody told me once that my privileges were like oxygen. And that's very true. It is very difficult to be aware of one's privileges. I mean, we all, have them to one degree or another, but it becomes almost impossible to imagine other people's lives. It's work. And if you don't do that work, it's extremely easy to assume that your life is normal.
Exactly.
So listen, y'all, you've heard me tell a lot of stories about Policy Genius over the years. Policy Genius, just to be clear, is not an insurance company. It's a marketplace that helps people find and buy insurance. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. So I know we talk a lot about death on this podcast, and then we use that talk about death to talk about Policy Genius. But for serious, you probably need life insurance, and Policy Genius is a great place
to get it. Check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. Policy Genius, because you will leave behind people who love and need you. That's not their tagline, but, you know, I like it.
All right, Mom, a somewhat less complicated question.
Oh, good.
But I'll be interested to see if this divides us.
Okay.
This question is from Jones, who writes, Dear Hank and John, what is the proper phrase? Slice of pizza or piece of pizza?
Well, you know, when I was growing up.
Yeah.
In Alabama.
There was no pizza.
Exactly.
Is that true?
Well, we had Pasquale's Pizza, which was in Crestline.
Wait, so you're telling me that when you were a child, there was one pizza place?
And yes, and mostly your grandmother would roll out Bisquick and put some tomato sauce with cheese on it and call it done. So I don't think, and that actually, then I had real pizza and I went, huh. Billy Grace really actually did not know how to make pizza.
She was a wonderful woman. She was not an expert pizza chef.
No, she was not that. So, what do we say? I think, can I have a piece of pizza?
So you would say piece of pizza?
Yeah, I think that's what I say.
I also say piece of pizza, probably because that's what I grew up saying.
Probably.
But also because I really like the alliteration of it. It's sort of like saying yes. Pizza.
Yes.
And I find that enjoyable.
Okay.
But I think, I know lots of, like in New York, for instance, they refer to slices.
Yes.
You know, there's always like, can I have a slice? And you go to a pizza place and they give you a slice for $2 or whatever. Probably $3.
Yeah, probably. Maybe $5. Yeah. I'm always fascinated with the cultural differences and describing things. Like, you know, those things on the stove, the little round things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you say that?
I do not refer to those things. I don't have a word for them. I would love to have a word.
Yes,
give me
one. Yes, you know.
No. The grill?
No, that turns on, turns red, cooks the food. It's
the
called...
stovetop?
No.
I've never known what to call them. The grill? The stovetop?
The burners?
The burners. I say burners.
Yes. And you know what my mother always said?
What?
Billy Grace always called them the eye of the stove.
Because
they look like eyes.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I think we should start calling it the eye of the stove. We should bring that back.
Okay.
The other regionalism I think about a lot is that, I don't know if this was true for you when you were a kid in the South, but when I was a kid... when somebody asked me what I wanted to drink, I said a Coke, and then they said what kind, and then I said a Sprite. Like, Coke was the word for soda.
Yes. This probably won't make the podcast, but I had a friend whose job when they graduated from college was to go around for Coca-Cola and he had a good palate, and he tasted Coke. He would go into a restaurant, order a Coke, and they would say, okay, and bring him a Coke. And if it was a Pepsi, he would write the Coca-Cola company, and they would send a letter to the restaurant saying, you got to call it Pepsi, because they were trying to make sure that there was that distinction, because people were starting to call soda Coke, and that... would affect their patent.
I think that's fascinating, actually. I'm super interested in trademark law, and one thing that all companies are terrified of is the genericization of their trademarks.
Yes, that's exactly
because
what he did for a living.
Because if you just start calling soda Coke, then Coke loses the ability to be the only thing called Coke.
Yes.
That's why when we talk about Googling, people at Google always talk about search.
Yes.
They never use the verb to Google.
Yes, and you've talked about this before in your podcast.
Do you remember when Hank was on a very important business call with Yahoo many, many years ago? And they were like, so I don't know how familiar you are with everybody on the call. And Hank said, oh, I Googled all of you. And then immediately afterwards, this voice comes over and she said, we call it Yahooing. Just such a ludicrous verb. I Yahooed you. No, don't worry.
It's almost like a poem. I know Yahooed you.
I know your full resume. I Yahooed you. Now we're going to go completely off track.
Okay.
Because I'm going to tell the story of Sarah on one of our first dates. Sarah grew up in the South, but she has a northern family.
Yes.
So she has a very interesting accent. She always wanted to sound generically American and not Southern, but she grew up around Southern people, and this made her a lot of times puts the emphasis on the first syllable, no matter what, like insurance or umbrella or garage or whatever.
Yeah.
But she doesn't have an accent. She just does that one trick.
Yes.
And so on one of our first dates, she said something about... But she's conscious of it, so she's always trying to like work against it. So she said something about Yahoo Mail, and I was like, "What?" And she said, "You know, Yahoo, the company."
And you just wanted to go back, Yahoo.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know where you got that from, man. That's super weird.
Oh, Sarah.
Oh man. All right. Okay, Mom, let's answer a few more questions from our listeners before we get to the exciting news from AFC Wimbledon and your excellent recipe. This question comes from D-Len, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, I am afraid of making phone calls. When calling or receiving calls from my family or my best friend, I feel fine, but other stuff freaks me out. When making appointments or calling strangers, I get really nervous and my stomach is in knots for days. I even sometimes ignore my phone if I'm getting a call from someone I know or am friends with. I usually text them later and pretend I was busy, but I feel bad about not answering. I also just really need to make calls every now and then, and I'd like to avoid this hassle. I know doing it is probably the only way to get over this, but how do I start? How do I make myself just call them?"
Well, I think, as you know, John, this is probably one of my biggest issues with anxiety, and I'm terrible at this. Again, there are reasons why I'm married to your dad for 40 years.
Yeah.
This is one. He'll make phone calls for me. And the armrest.
But we now know the keys to a good marriage. You need one person who can make phone calls, and you need to have an agreement that whoever's in the middle seat gets the armrest.
Yeah. Yes. And then the rest will all fall in place.
That's terrible advice.
Isn't this supposed to be dubious advice?
Extremely dubious.
Okay, fine.
Oh, answer these two questions, and I will marry you.
Yeah, no, please don't make a decision based on those. So I really struggle with this. I still really struggle with this. And one of the tricks that I do, because I really do get anxious about phone calls, is there are times in the day when I feel stronger, like between 10 and 1 o'clock are my strongest times emotionally and mentally. And so I will postpone those phone calls, but I'll write them down, and then I will call between 10 and 1, and I get the great joy of putting a line through the name. And that's just that's my trick. And the other is, now that I'm 64, I get my permission. But you can't do this. This is really dubious advice. You have to wait till you're 64. I give myself permission to tell people that I'm sorry that I don't return their phone call, and then communicate through text. That's really not that healthy of a strategy.
Well, I mean,
maybe it is.
You do whatever you need to do. I also feel somewhat anxious about having phone calls with strangers. I feel it much less now than I used to. My anxiety has found other ports of call.
I'm still stuck on phone calls.
I have to say, when I hired Rosianna, my amazing, brilliant production partner, the first question I asked her is, "Do you mind calling strangers?" And she said, "No, I like calling strangers." And that was not a lie. It is amazing. To me, it's like she has a superpower.
Yeah.
If I'm incredibly lucky that if I feel anxious about something, like about a phone call, that I have someone who will make the phone call, essentially make it for me.
Rosie is your dad.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I give her yes, I guess so. But so like my mother, I have an anxiety disorder. I have, like, for instance, an incredibly hard time mailing things. It's very easy for me to put the thing in the envelope. It's very easy for me to seal the envelope, to put the stamp on it, to write the correct name, the return address, etc. The part that is difficult is the part where I walk to the mailbox, I put the item in the mailbox, and I lift that little flag that lets the mail carrier know that I wish to send a letter. I recognize that this is ludicrous, right? That, like, people can do this. Lots of people do it. It isn't physically taxing. And I feel the same way about phone calls in a lot of ways. Like, it's easy to minimize it because lots of people can do it, because it's ostensibly very easy to do, etc. Except that it doesn't matter that it's easy for other people to do it. It doesn't matter that it's supposedly not hard. It is hard. Like, it's very hard for you, and you are living inside of the only consciousness that you can live inside of. So if I treat it as a thing that's hard, that I am going to do, and that after I finish this hard thing, I will be proud of myself in the way that I am proud of myself when I do hard things, it somehow becomes easier. Like, I build up sort of rituals around it. I make it, I take it into tiny little steps. You know, there's the step of dialing. There's the step of hitting the call button. For me, there's the step of picking up the letter and walking it out of the house. And then there's the step where I open up the mailbox. And then there's the step where I put it in, the step where I close the mailbox, where I raise the flag, where I walk back feeling this immense joy because I have done this thing that for me is genuinely difficult. And so I think for me, like, that helps. But I think different things help different people.
Yep.
Mom, it is almost time for us to move on to the very exciting new segment where you tell us how to use Dr. Pepper to make pork chops. Is that what we're making?
No, we're making pork tenderloin.
Pork tenderloin. I apologize. Not only do I not know what the eye of the stove is called, I don't even know what a pork tenderloin is, apparently.
Liked it.
I loved it. No, I grew up eating pork tenderloin. I know about it. Anyway, we have a couple of responses from previous podcasts that are very important, in addition to the fact that Tuggle is not dead.
Yay.
We have a couple other updates. This from Skip.
But my writes, college life was.
I know, your college life is dead. I'm sorry, Mom.
Okay, sorry.
This update is from Skip, who writes, Dear Hank and John, in your most recent podcast, you mentioned the Yellowstone supervolcano and how John would like to move to Australia in the case of an imminent eruption. I would just like to point out that the world's most active caldera supervolcano is located in Tasmania. There is no escape.
Oh, God, there isn't.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, the good news, Mom, is that when the supervolcano comes, it will be an exceptionally slow death, because really we'll end up, like, all dying of, like, starvation, because the cloud of ash will make it so there is no sunshine and therefore no crops.
Boy, I'm excited about that possibility.
So we'll be desperate.
Yes.
We'll be terrified.
Yes.
There will be no internet.
Yes.
And then everything will end.
Okay, then. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
And now I'm going back into therapy.
We have one more update. This one is from Kansi, who writes, in reply to John's thoughts on writing his next novel completely in emojis. Mom, do you know what an emoji is?
I do know.
All right.
There's those little things that they're supposed to mean things. Like,
do you have a favorite emoji? Do you use them?
I do. I really and truly hate all the smiley faces one, just on general principle, because they're yellow and I don't like the color yellow.
You can actually change their colors now, but go on.
Okay, well, that might make me feel better. I like the snake one.
Oh, yeah, you love snakes.
I do love snakes.
Yeah, my mom is a painter of snakes, just a fan of snakes in general.
Yep.
It's
yep.
not a passion I share with you.
So few do.
I did come across, I was kayaking yesterday, and I came across a small water snake that was perhaps 6 inches long, and I thought of at least trying to photograph it for Henry, but then I became very anxious, so I didn't.
Do you remember the time that the snake ate your fish at the cabin?
I do.
Yeah, that was very upsetting.
We had had this amazing fishing day.
Yes, incredible.
Like, the best fishing day ever.
Ever.
And, and then a snake ate our fish. It was very upsetting, and it was very gross to watch it happen, and it was a little bit traumatic. So my two main memories from childhood, breaking your cookie jar and the snake eating the fish. All right, anyway.
This is such visuals.
This is from Cansey, who writes, in reply to John's thoughts on writing his next novel completely in emojis, I wanted to share that there is already a book by the artist Zhu Bing that does exactly that. It's called From Point to Point, and it is a 112-page novel about the everyday life of an office worker. If you Google it, you can find images of the pages. It's surprisingly comprehensible. Not really a question.
Really?
Just love the podcast.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
That's very cool. We have to look that up.
Well, I did Google some images of it. We'll try to put them on the Patreon. And let me show... I can show you what it looks like, Mom.
Okay.
And then we can show people on the podcast. But it is kind of readable. It looks like this. Isn't that cool?
Oh, that is very cool.
Yeah. So it's like... It is just a novel in emojis, which I do think... by the way, I think is completely legitimate. I know that lots of people...
totally.
Yeah. I think if you can use... There's all kinds of different ways to use language, and language isn't just made of letters.
That's absolutely true.
Okay, so it's now time to talk about the news from AFC Wimbledon.
I'm so excited.
But first, what is your recipe?
Oh, my recipe. Well, it's important to know that where this recipe comes from.
Okay.
Because it comes from Gracie.
Right, my cousin Grace.
Yes. And we love the Gracie, as we all like to say. So Gracie's boyfriend, Trace Barnard, he's a chef in New Orleans. He owns a restaurant called We Got Soul. And I noticed on his menu that he prints weekly that he had a pork tenderloin that was marinated in your favorite soda.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pepper.
Dr. Pepper.
Well, it must be said. I don't love Dr. Pepper. I feel like it's a little too rich for my palate.
Yes.
But Diet Dr. Pepper, not as good of a marinade.
No, but you have to have that richness for a good marinade. So you have to use the straight stuff.
All right. So it's pork tenderloin.
Yep.
Marinated.
And Dr. Pepper. Mm-hmm. And brown sugar and crushed red pepper and a vanilla bean and bay leaves. And you cook it, which is kind of fun to cook Dr. Pepper. It bubbles a lot. And reduce it by half, cool it off, put the pork in there, let it marinate for at least 8 hours, and then grill it. And it's fantastic.
I have to say, I was deeply impressed.
Oh, I was too. Trace, he's a good chef.
I had low expectations, but I was very, very impressed. Today's podcast...
Oh, it's brought to you by Dr. Pepper. Not only good for your taste, but good for your soul.
Oh, there we go. That's a nice advertisement for Trace's restaurant. And today's podcast is also brought to you by The Middle Seat. The Middle Seat. You have the right to both armrests.
And do it via touching arm hair.
If necessary. Whatever it takes.
And this podcast is brought to you by The End of College.
The end of college. It doesn't really end until you lose your cookie jar. And lastly, this podcast is brought to you by a super volcano set to erupt at any moment in Tasmania or possibly the United States. We have essentially no way of knowing. Or if we do have a way of knowing, we don't have a science person on the podcast right now to tell us that we should be calm about this. So we're going to panic.
Okay, that sounds like a good... strategy for the two of us.
All right, Mom. The news from AFC Wimbledon is that as this podcast is aired, I will be in London with Rosianna and your husband, my dad, and a few other people from here in Indianapolis at Wembley Stadium, a 90,000-seat stadium, where AFC Wimbledon will be playing in the playoff final for all the marbles. Right now, as I'm talking, AFC Wimbledon has a 50% chance of having a 100% chance of becoming a third-tier English soccer team next year. The game is just, it's incredibly exciting. It's almost impossible to contextualize how unlikely this is. For instance, AFC Wimbledon has the smallest stadium in League 2, the league they're currently in.
Really?
Yeah, King's Meadow is the smallest stadium in League 2. And yet somehow they have found their way one victory against Plymouth Argyle from then having the smallest stadium in League One. I'm really, really excited. I mean, obviously, I desperately hope that AFC Wimbledon win the game. If you see me at Wembley, please feel free to say hi. It would be great to be able to meet you. Thanks to I know lots of Dear Hank and John listeners are going to the game at Wembley, which is so cool.
Oh, that's cool.
Thank you for getting on board with my eccentric passion for this football club. But I talked to in the last couple of days. I've talked to both the founding commercial director of the club and the CEO, and they're so excited. They're so excited to be Nerdfighteria's club. They're so excited to be playing at Wembley. And I'm looking forward to having a great day out, no matter what happens, because it is already wonderful to have made it to Wembley. Mm. It's a massive, massive deal for the club, both in terms of, you know, coverage and financially and everything. But obviously, it will be an especially great day out if the improbable happens and Wimbledon go up. It would just be absolutely magical.
That's such a great, great story. I'm so excited that you guys are going. I know your dad is just really thrilled. And the good news is he'll be there to keep you calm at all times. And if you need to make a phone call, he's happy to do it.
Not only that.
And he'll mail a letter for you.
He'll mail a letter for me. I feel like Dad will probably give me the armrest.
Yeah,
if it's an emergency.
Totally, yes, he will.
So, yeah, he's a good guy. I was going to say our dad, but he's not your dad.
No,
he's not. But I'm used to talking to Hank. Mom, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode of Dear Hank and John. You've been my favorite guest host ever and the only one that I've ever had, but still my favorite.
Ah, thanks.
And thanks to everybody for listening. We really appreciate it. Today's podcast is edited by Nicholas Jenkins. Our intern is Claudia Morales. Rosiana Hals-Rojas helps us out with questions. If you want to ask us a question, you can email us at hankandjohn@gmail.com or use the hashtag on Twitter, Dear Hank and John. If you want to ask my mom a question, you can do that as well. You can just use the same hashtag and I'll have her look for it. But thanks again for listening. Our theme music is by Gunnarola. I always forget our theme music is by Gunnarola. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at John Green. Hank is at Hank Green. Mom, what's your Twitter? You don't really remember?
I don't.
Hold on, I'll look it up for you. I think it's Mom Vlog Brothers.
I think it is Mom Vlog Brothers.
It is. It's confirmed to be Mom Vlog Brothers. Right now, on top of her Twitter feed, you can see a snake skin. She's not kidding about the snakes, people.
Oh, that's how I decorate.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It looks great. Thanks again for listening. And as we say in my hometown, don't forget to be awesome.